everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 9th, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And just so that you guys know, when I say today is Monday, November 9th, that's because today, the day that you first get this episode available to you and perhaps download it or live stream it, is Monday, November 9th. But I'm recording this on Wednesday, November 4th, which means that I have no idea how the American election is going to go. We are still counting votes in key battleground states. As of the recording of this episode, Joe Biden actually has 264 electoral votes. President Trump has 214 electoral votes. For those of you who are not as familiar with the American political landscape, you need 270 electoral votes to win. The votes that are outstanding still have not completed their counts. And we don't know what is going to happen in the coming days. So by the time you listen to this, you have a lot more knowledge than I do. So that is not going to be the focus of this week's episode. Think of this as a welcome, not distraction per se, but a welcome change of pace than what you've been kind of stressing over for the past full 7 days. This week, I actually have the opportunity to speak with an incredible science reporter. But before we dive into that, I do want to thank those of you who help make Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because of the support from listeners just like you. If you want to pledge your support, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. You can pledge at any amount, even a dollar an episode. It goes such a long way to help out. This week's top supporters include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Charles Bleel? Maybe it's Blell. I think it might be Bleel. Thank you guys so very much. All right. This week, I have the opportunity to chat with Zach St. George. He's a science reporter who specifically focuses on climate change and conservation. And he has a new book. It came out earlier this year called The Journeys of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. So without any further ado, here he is, Zach St. George. Zach, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to finally catch up with you. I feel like this is one of those interviews that has been on the books for a while because your book came out over the summer, right?
Yeah, it came out in mid-July.
Most excellent, which I know I've talked to so many authors on the show this year about how putting all your blood, sweat, and tears into a book and then having it be released in the middle of a global pandemic has been, let's say, interesting to say the least.
Yeah. It was, I kind of expected some amount of just the anticlimax of the Christmas afternoon or something after all the presents are open when you're a little kid. But it was, definitely a little bit like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, the good news, I guess, and the cool thing about doing all of this stuff remotely and digitally is that it feels like there's a longer lifespan. It feels like we can go deep, right? Like we've got an hour here to dive into these topics. So you don't have to speak in the sound bites that you're expected to when you do quick hits on the radio.
Right.
And that's good because this is kind of a crazy story. Like, okay, so your book is called The Journeys of Trees, because that is a plural situation.
Everybody.
Yeah. Rolls off the tongue. The Journeys of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. And I think at first blush, you sort of gloss over. You're like, oh, The Journeys of Trees. And then you realize, no, he's literally talking about migration. Like, trees moving as a function of Darwinian evolution, as an idea of trying to adapt and, kind of move in order to find, I guess, a more acceptable climate, knowing that the planet is changing so rapidly right now. So this is like a crazy concept that trees go somewhere else. I mean, obviously, they're not like picking up and walking. How do forests migrate?
Yeah. I mean, basically, we know that every species has some ability to move around, right? Like as a collective entity, a species, you know, every time, a herd of bison might wander around during their lifetime. But if you kind of take a long-term view of things, you can see the same type of collective movement with plants. You know, this is one of the big things that we're going to see with climate change. We're going to see species shifting their ranges due to changing conditions and kind of their, you know, evolved preferences and ability to evolve. So I wrote about it with trees just because, you know, trees are like this symbol of permanence and, you know, from a human perspective, we go in a forest and we kind of see this steady, almost permanent presence. So, this story of what climate change is going to do to the arrangement of the world's living things, I think is really one of the central questions of climate change and one of the central effects. So tackling it through trees, which are, again, kind of the symbol of steadiness, I just found to be kind of an interesting way to go at it.
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely counterintuitive that an entire forest over time could, you know, migrate. And I think I understand how, because, well, I don't know, I'm imagining how in my mind, but maybe just to indulge me, bison have legs. So even though, yes, on a global perspective, like an entire herd or like a whole population of bison might shift hundreds of miles because, you know, over time, the individuals are actually physically walking. But how do trees can't walk?
Yeah, so you're right. It's very much a collective action. It is no individual tree is doing a lot of moving around. That is true. It's pretty similar though in concept. Like basically, the arrangement of plants that we see around us it reflects conditions on some level. So it reflects, if you see a plant in a place, it means the conditions in that place are suitable for that plant whenever it was a seed. So there's suitable conditions and it managed to get there. And so the movement of a forest, what happens is as conditions change, seeds sprout in new places, succeed in new places, and kind of drag their species along. And so, it is pretty slow. You know, most people aren't just going to notice it kind of walking around. But scientists who have set up plots where they've really tracked what is in this place, they can see, oh, there's new species coming in. So you can track it that way. You can also see it through the fossil record. And you can see that as conditions change, species move around and trees and forests move around.
Okay. And so logistically, it's really a function of like how the seeds are spread. So if a seed falls to the ground, if it has something on it that allows it to be airborne, if it attaches to animals that move around and sort of hitches a ride, then finds itself in dirt that has the nutrients that are expected, the right temperature, the right humidity, all that good stuff, and can thrive. Now it's in a new place. If it finds itself in a place that's desiccated or that doesn't have the right nutritional kind of content, it just won't sprout, it'll do it at a lower kind of density or a lower number. And that's the slow but steady shift.
Yeah, right. And again, it's kind of hard to imagine in the moment. But if you think about like long-term, like, you know, imagining an ice sheet retreating across North America as at the end of the Pleistocene. You can kind of imagine trees like following collectively. So visually, it's kind of much easier to think about from a distance. But, right. But yeah, I mean, it's one by one. It's trees floating around, seeds floating around. It's like maple helicopters. It's, acorns carried by squirrels. There's so many different ways that seeds get around. But each of those new little seedlings can kind of be viewed as a piece of a collective as it's part of the species. And when a seed sprouts somewhere new, it's changing the borders of where that species exists.
And so this obviously isn't like completely random or like willy-nilly. Climate change has unfortunately induced some pretty specific patterns and also just human sort of intervention beyond climate change. Like, we know that climate change is anthropogenic, right? People are putting these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and that, along with all sorts of other pressures, is changing the climate. But also, we're like hacking down trees, we're like effing up habitat left and right, and depleting soil content, or like mining for gold, and like, you know, poisoning water supplies nearby. And so when all of these things happen, I'm guessing that these are also sort of new, even though they're artificial environmental pressures that these organisms are having to contend with.
Yeah. So if you go back through, you know, the fossil record, you can see these instances of climate change, and you can see that they have really dramatic effects on the arrangement of species and trees and forests. You don't see a ton of extinction coming out of that for plants. And some of that, you know, probably has to do, there's some theories about it, but a lot of it probably has to do with the fact that it's just really hard to kill plants in general. I mean, if you've ever tried to like weed your garden, it's pretty goddamn hard to get rid of like every bit of ivy out of your garden or whatever. What you do see is a lot of rearrangement, and you do see a lot of like local extirpation. So you see a lot of local extinction, where a species that used to be in one area is no longer there. And so the complication we're now dealing with is, as you say, humans have just cut down, I think, a third of or half of the world's forests, scientists estimate, over the kind of era of human agriculture. If you look at Google Maps, I was doing this recently. I just moved out to Baltimore last year and was for some reason on Google Maps. And if you zoom out, like the eastern United States is really lush and green and beautiful. But if you zoom in, it is really crazy to just see how much of it is like actually not continuous green. I mean, you can just see the extent of habitat destruction and habitat change,
right?
Like, is just
like crazy. Which ones are forests? Yeah. And which ones are like ornamentals that were planted for,
right?
Yeah.
Or just like fringes around somebody's yard that are left. But so, I mean, the point is basically that we know that species and plants and trees in particular have shown ability to move around and track climate change in the past. But I think there is some question about whether it's going to be as easy and successful this time. And so it's something people have worried about for a long time, whether a lot of species would keep up with the rate of climate change and manage to arrive in those suitable places.
Right, because it seems like it's a two-pronged problem. One is that there are all of these kind of human-induced changes sort of irrespective of climate change, deforestation, depletion of the soil through agricultural growth. And, you know, like we talked about, like these kind of like toxic things going into the soil, pollution, but also just the rate of climate change is insane. Like when you talk about these fossil records and these shifts, these are plants that A, like you said, it's kind of hard to kill a plant, but also this is happening over like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. Like now we're talking about decades.
Right, right.
That's a massive difference in terms of like, how is an organism expected to adapt to change so dramatically and so quickly? Some of them can, and some of them just, it's not, they don't have the genetic flexibility for it.
Right, right. And yeah, I mean, I think it still remains to be seen a little bit. Like, you know, there's a lot of debate about how fast species are capable of moving and trees mm-hmm. are capable of moving. There was one study from, it was kind of a statistics study from the, I think the early 1990s that said kind of theoretically there's no upper limit to how fast tree species can move because, you know, if you have a random planting every once in a while, it can kind of, you can take the whole species pretty far. But yeah. I think practically, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the rate of change is potentially a big problem. And I think we're already seeing, I can't cite the paper, but I remember reading something recently about kind of local extirpations or something we're already seeing that seem to be climate driven and not just the background of horrible habitat destruction that this is kind of piling on top of.
Right. I mean, I'm not surprised. And I guess kind of going back to the question that I was sort of asking around the question, because I was trying to develop it in my mind as I was asking it. But, you know, we often think about kind of classic migration patterns of animals. So, you know, birds, they might go to a warmer area in the winter so that they don't die, you know, they don't freeze to death. Or we think of kind of classic patterns where certain mammals will hibernate to hide out the winter. And these are like seasonal, cyclical sort of migration patterns or behavioral patterns. In terms of climate change, you know, is this just like, are we seeing all the plants moving north? Like how, what are these kind of patterns that are becoming induced by climate change?
Yeah, this is pretty nerdy, but one of my favorite pieces in this whole thing. I mean, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a reporter. I kind of came into this writing about science.
Just a reporter. You know, no, you just translate science for like everybody. You know,
yeah, I try.
Totally easy job. Yeah.
In any case, one of the fun questions about this whole thing is like, how are plants and trees going to react? Is that it's really hard to tell why they're in the places they are right now. Which means that it's hard to predict in the future. And what I mean by it's hard to tell why they are where they are now is if you look at a range map of a species, well, that's maybe not a very good example. I guess just like if you look at a tree in your yard or something, mm-hmm. So you know that if it's there, that the physical conditions are suitable for it, right? So,
yeah,
you know, the nutrients or whatever, and the temperature is fine. It's not getting killed off over the winter. Okay, so you know the physical situation is okay. Then there's the biological situation, the biological factors. So there's nothing that's killing it. If it needs, you know, mycorrhizal fungi or something in order to thrive, those are there. So the presence of this tree means that the physical and biological factors or conditions are okay. And the third piece is that it managed to arrive. So maybe it planted itself, you know, a maple floating down on its little helicopter wings, or maybe someone planted it. But in any case, so there's physical and biological conditions are good, and then it also managed to get there. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to say why a species is in a place or why an individual is in a place. The conditions are good and it managed to get there. It's really hard to do that in the negative.
Right.
So if a species is not in a place, is it the problem that the physical conditions are no good? Is it that the biological conditions are no good? Or is it maybe just that the conditions are fine, but it didn't manage to get there.
Sure.
But so when we're looking at the present layout of the world, we can see where things are and have kind of a very broad idea of why they are, why they're in those places. You know, they can survive there and they manage to arrive, but we don't know why they're not in those places. Mm-hmm. Or we don't know why they're not, why they're, where they're not. So what that means in terms of predicting how the world is going to react is that we can kind of see, we can make models mostly based on kind of physical characteristics. So we can match species ranges to kind of topographical and climatic maps and sort of get a sense of, say, like, okay, these are the physical conditions that this species occurs in. And then we try to project
that. This tropical tree is not going to thrive in like Vermont, for example.
Yeah. And even in a more, you know, scientists will make models like climate niche or climate envelope models that try to approximate, like, these are the conditions that this species needs. And then they'll project them out into the future and say, okay, you know, this is where this thing's going to exist in the future if the climate does this. But again, the reason we're seeing species in these places, but we don't totally know why they're where they are and why they're not where they're not. And so it becomes hard to predict what's going to happen as you turn the temperature. Like, is it going to tip the balance of competition to this other closely related species? Is it going to, you know, is there going to be some other effect? And so I'm circling back to your question, which was, you know, is there a specific pattern that we're looking to see? And basically, what I was just telling you is all to say that what we see in the past is that climate change, in a very broad way, if it gets warmer, things move north and upslope, or poleward if you're in the southern hemisphere, and upslope. And if it gets cooler, they move downslope and towards the equator. But kind of in a more specific way, you don't see this like predictable linear pattern. You see these really crazy things happen. You see groups of species rise and fall that are unlike any that currently exist, or you see some species suddenly get common or some suddenly get rare. You see all these crazy things that don't look like the world as it is today. So I think, again, a long answer to your question, but I think what we can expect is surprising situations that are unlike what we know today.
Interesting, because like not only are we trying to model the actual change of the climate, but we're also trying to model the ability of a specific species to like how widely they are able to adapt quickly. Like, we know obviously that, like, you know, X tree thrives in this environment best, but we don't know if X tree with, like, you know, Y change can handle that. Like, because it's never had to before, for example, unless we were able to induce these things experimentally. Like, we think about things too, and our perspective, I think, is in many ways, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's sort of colored, or it's sort of constrained by what we tend to think of as normalcy, because, you know, we're out and about and we're observing things and we're making heuristics and templates all the time. So, like, I live in Los Angeles. And if you didn't know this, you would totally think that the palm trees that are all over Los Angeles are native to Los Angeles. That, like, of course, palm trees are, it's an LA staple. Like, of course, they must have just been here for millions of years. But until you knew that they were all transplanted from Mexico and that they don't, like, they are not a native species, are you then like, oh, weird? Like, something that I think of as so definitive here never would have been here if we hadn't brought it, but look how well it does.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of exactly the point. Like, why were there not palm trees in Los Angeles? It's clearly not because they don't thrive, and that we've really proved that point over and over and over again, over the last, you know, however many thousand years of moving species around the world, we find over and over again that maybe the place where we find species is not actually where they do best, or anything like the only places they could grow.
You know, I'm wondering, because you've done so much digging into this, and it's a little bit off topic, because I do want to get into some of the really interesting stories in the book, because one thing that people might not realize when they see that it's a book about trees is that in a lot of ways it's about people, which that's actually what we care about, because we're all like narcissistic human beings. And so I love that, because you really tap into that in an important way. But before we get to that, I'm wondering how much you've sort of investigated or even maybe philosophically grappled with the idea of indigenous or native species, especially when it comes to plant species. And like, what does that even really mean? Because as long as human beings, and I'm talking 200,000 years ago, human beings have been on the scene, we have been like fucking shit up.
Yeah, I think fucking shit up is like the lesson of ecology. It's like unintended consequences. I mean, I guess when it comes to like native and non-natives, you're right. It's not a biological question, or it's not as easily answered biologically as it is philosophically. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I'm just going to put this on like the local native plant societies tend to be very dogmatic. No plant that's not from here should be here. And then on the other side, I've experienced a lot of people like in the San Francisco Bay Area and all over California, there's tons of eucalyptus. And so particularly in the Bay Area, there's a lot of debate about whether eucalyptus, which is native to Australia, should be in California. And it gets really heated. You have the, like I say, the native plant people on the one side who just want to cut them all down. And then you have other people who say, you know, they're as native as we are. I'm not as dogmatic as either kind of those extremes. I sort of feel like, if something was in a continent, like during the Pleistocene, so like during the last 2.5 million years when we had a bunch of glaciations and species shifted all over the place, like if it was in the same continent or like, you know, same, let's say, side of the continent during that time, then it's kind of like, well, it's, you know, it's been mixing with the other species on that continent. It's probably encountered those species at some point. So it's probably not the end of the world. But, you know, if you want to bring something over from Australia like that, it's like, well, those have not encountered each other in evolutionary time for, you know, maybe tens of millions of years or hundreds of millions of years even. So right. I think there's degrees, you know, and I think it has to do with evolutionary time is probably the way to look at it.
Because we use language as a descriptive or categorizational tool to help us make sense of this complicated question. And so like you'll hear words like, well, that's an invasive species, which means that, okay, it wasn't quote naturally here, or it didn't come here on its own, like maybe human beings brought it here, but it is thriving, and it's thriving so much that it's actually taking over the ecological niche of the native species, which maybe, unfortunately, don't have the evolutionary or like adaptive capacities. And that's a problem, right? Like it really can't just be, quote, survival of the fittest, because then it's all just like jellyfish and weeds.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's impossible to extract ourselves from the situation. And like some of the examples I use, I talk about in the book with invasive species are species of insect and fungus that have killed off these really beloved American trees, the American chestnut, American elm, and American ash species. And it's not killing, it hasn't, none of these species have driven the trees extinct, but they have made them kind of functionally extinct. So they're not really, they're so rare, they're so diminished that they're not really playing a role in the ecosystem. But so, I mean, if you're measuring it by extinction, then yeah, maybe that's not a big deal to have these new species come over and kind of shake things up. Yeah, who cares? Nothing went extinct. You have actual greater biodiversity because now you have two species you didn't have. But, you know, it's like, well, shit, I really liked the American elms that grew along my street. I really liked the whole Appalachian forest of chestnut trees, you know? So yeah, I think it's, when we talk about moving things around, really, when we talk about almost anything we do in, to, or by nature, I think it's hard to separate, you know, human actions and preferences and desires.
Yeah. And I think it sort of reinforces to me this, I don't know, like awakening that I had, or this realization that I had, even in recent years when I've, you know, made multiple trips to the African continent, and I've talked with a lot of people about conservation of these sort of charismatic animal species and what conservation hunting is and how poaching has affected species. And I think one thing that sort of slapped me in the face that, you know, really made me be like, how the hell was I so naive before this, was that like, nothing is just wild in the sense that we want to believe it is. Everything is managed. You know, there are fences that exist all over the world. Anytime there is a population of, you know, anything from sequoias to elephants, the vast majority of them have been counted, tagged, are being observed, and are being actively managed, whether it's to maintain their numbers, to grow their numbers, or to deplete their numbers based on how we have measured and decided that the ecological health of the, you know, entire sort of system is doing. And I think that I didn't really fully understand that until I saw it in true form. I kind of just assumed, like many Americans do, that like, ooh, Africa is wild, you know? And there's just, and that's not to say that these aren't wild animals. They're not in cages. They have massive roaming areas, and they, you know, but these places are observed. They are managed. We know what's going on for the most part in almost every part of the planet. And I think we've just been told stories about, you know, the deepest Amazon and but like when I visited the Amazon, it was like, oh, I'm in this ecotourism lodge and like they know exactly what's going on and they've counted all the trees in the canopy here and they know exactly which ones are producing which fruits. And it like kind of woke me up a little bit about how much our human hands have been kind of laying on nature. And I'm not saying that as like putting a lot of negative valence on it, because these conservation efforts are what's helping things survive. I mean, it would be so much worse without them. But I think that this idea that like half the world is just wild and untouched is like a really naive view.
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree with you. I mean, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about zooming in on Google Maps. I think you can do that anywhere nowadays and see the extent of our impact. I think the only addition I would make to what you said is that, you know, as much as we have our hands in everything, we often don't know like what we're squashing. We're super ignorant of like a lot of what we're doing. And I'm not talking about the conservationists. I'm just talking about, you know, habitat, our impact on the world in general. We often are probably doing more than we even know.
Like our everyday decisions that we think of as only affecting whatever the problem we're solving is in the moment is having like, like a butterfly effect kind of impact, like downstream all sorts of things are changing.
And we're just so ignorant of life. I mean, we still haven't described most of the species on Earth. We still don't know most of what's out there. So we're profoundly ignorant, but I can tell you more about trees if you
Yeah, I would love to. And I think one of the things that I'm so interested in, and I know that you touch on this through multiple tree stories, is this idea of sort of environmentalist, or like maybe even we should take it more specific and say interest groups that are particularly focused on something that they deem important or charismatic. So you'll have a group of people who care a lot about like this one species. And there's this really interesting paradox that happens, right? Where they do so much good in because they're fighting in a way that nobody else would. And so like they're affecting change in a way that if not for them, maybe this species might have gone extinct. But then on the flip side of that, it's sort of like, how and why has this specific species been chosen? And what other downstream effects are happening in putting all of our efforts or you know, resourcing our finances to this one thing? And I mean, that actually extends bigger to like the Endangered Species Act and, you know, like the political kind of currency that goes into saying this species is endangered, this one is critical. It's not a simple scientific decision. I know that you've come across that with regards to certain tree species as well.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hard to separate the philosophy. One of the central stories that I told in this book, and it kind of is paralleled. There's lots of versions of this, but one was about this effort to save this tree called the Florida Torreya. And basically, it is in Florida, in the panhandle, a very rare endangered conifer. Since the 50s, it had been dying out from this fungus. And this woman named Connie Barlow learned about this tree, and she thought the problem was actually that it had gotten stuck at the end of the ice age, and it should not have been in Florida. It should have been in, you know, Georgia or even further north in Pennsylvania or somewhere. And so the fungus that it seemed to be suffering from was like a symptom of being in basically a poor climatic fit. And so she endeavored to move it north, and by which I mean send seeds to volunteers scattered across the eastern United States, and basically just they planted this tree on their property, and you know, to see how it did, and hopefully if it did well, it would naturalize, and you know, that would be the migration of the species. It was really controversial because, again, it's this old lesson in ecology of, you know, unintended consequences of trying to do something, trying to make something better, and possibly making it worse. But you know, so over and over, that was just one of many stories that I kind of encountered where there's people doing these things where like. On the one hand, it's like, okay, yeah, maybe that's a good way to save this species or this ecosystem or whatever. And on the other hand, you can also see where it goes wrong. Like maybe this tree becomes really invasive, or maybe the fungus really is the problem. And then you've now carried this fungus all over. And we do know that this fungus, as it happens, can infect other species of trees. So yeah, there's this question of, can we do anything without making it worse? And, you know, I think like Connie Barlow, this woman who led this effort, I think she views it as kind of this small thing that she can do because, you know, I think we're all looking around us and seeing that there's lots of problems in the world and wanting to do something about it. But you kind of have to bite off what you can chew and just try to do something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really admirable to see so many situations where individuals or like these small grassroots organizations are actually affecting change. And granted, it's sometimes still hard to know what the larger implications of that change will be. But without them, you know, probably nothing would be done. So I guess I'm curious to know, are there examples where these sort of small grassroots movements have actually spawned or led to a much larger change, or sort of like a conservation, you know, a larger conservation victory.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a lot in this book about the giant sequoias in the Southern Sierra there, Sierra mm-hmm. Nevada in California, and you know, those we modern people, the fact that they're still around speaks to the success that a lot of small groups had in the late 1800s and early and mid 1900s and really fighting for those. And they're kind of scattered in different groves. So it was difficult to kind of collectively protect them in that time period. So what ended up happening was a lot of individual people and groups fighting for their protection from logging and, you know, other resource sorts of interests than the usual suspects. You know, at the same time, I also write in the book about acclimatization societies. I can never say that, but basically these groups around the world that thought the best way to like improve, basically they were colonists, they were colonial, you know, whether it was mm-hmm. American or Australian or French and whatever colonies. Sorry, that sounds flippant, but these societies basically.
I mean, it is what it is, right? Like there are, these European countries that like fucking went over into other parts of the world and planted their flags and did a lot of atrocities.
Yeah. And so, I mean, these acclimatization societies, they thought that they could improve basically the rest of the world, the places that they colonized by introducing their favorite species from where they had come from. So they they just introduced all sorts of things. And, you know, so those were another, that's kind of like a grassroots organization that maybe seemed really small and noble in its day and useful and like on board with the sentiments of the time, but now it just looks abhorrent. So I think it's really hard to predict in advance which is going to be which, but you know, I think we owe a lot to kind of small groups of people just deciding to make a stand.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, you see it time and time again, for example, with the national parks here in the US, where you know, specific regions were petitioned. It was petitioned to the government to conserve them. And sometimes these things happen top down. You know, we know that Roosevelt did a lot of work, and we know that there's like just different regions where it was kind of decided. But there are a lot of examples where local communities pushed really, really hard to say, we can't just do this anymore at the city level or the state level. Like, we really need federal protections because this is a biodiversity hotspot. And if we lose it, humanity will be worse for it.
Right, right. Yeah. It's, you know, so like I say, as a journalist, I get to sort of meet a lot of these people and sort of present them mostly from a fairly impartial point of view. But I think kind of the fact that I ended up writing about a lot of these kind of people who are doing what maybe seems like, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but they're doing something. Mm-hmm. You know, I think at some level, the fact that I spent so much time on these people, I do kind of admire that. Even if I'm more inclined to write about those people than to actually like be out there doing this kind of kooky thing myself.
Just hugging trees all day, pitching a tent up there. You know, I think the big question that comes to mind then for me is that, or sort of the logical question that follows in my somewhat illogical brain, is that there are these amazing sort of conservation victories or these incredible historical decisions that have been made. But the way that we as human beings think, we often think in terms of hard line boundaries. So it's like, here, let me draw lines on a map and say what's within here is protected. But then your book is about the fact that migration is a function of survival for trees. And so when we protect, for example, the, you know, giant sequoias, and they're protected within these certain boundaries. What happens if and when the giant sequoias need to, on the whole, move, and they end up moving outside of those boundaries?
Yeah, I mean, so it's two sides that are equally easy to kind of perceive, and one being that you know, we needed to protect these species where they were, and it makes sense that, you know, for a sequoia, something that can live 3,000 years, for that to become the living monument and the living cathedral that they are, you know, it's necessary. We needed to protect them where they exist, because that's what we wanted to protect. On the other hand, as a species, you know, sequoias have migrated like every other species. They migrate, they move in response to changing conditions. And so at some point, you know, if the climate continues to change as we sort of imagine it will, you know, the place where they are currently is not going to be the best place for giant sequoias. You know, so I mean, I spoke with a paleoecologist named Jacqueline Gill the other day, and she's studied this stuff a lot and thought about it a lot. And she sort of said, you know, pointed out that in the media, sort of species migration and like, oh, this crab is showing up in this new place or something, you know, it's often presented as like either a curiosity or B, a negative. But she said to me, you know, I would be worried if things weren't migrating. And so I think the migration is necessary and good, but when you then go back to something like the sequoias, where it's like, we really care about this specific ecosystem as it currently exists. I think that's where it's really difficult to sort of, you know, fully think through the implications of climate change and what that means.
Right. And I mean, the thing is, obviously, this is a vastly complicated issue. And obviously, there are amazing wins that we can look at historically, and just like horrific losses that we can look at historically with regards to our sort of human perception and intervention when it comes to these organisms. I guess the big sort of take home that I struggle with a lot is this a function of just like barricading ourselves outside of nature? Like, if we changed our way of life that was less concrete, you know, fewer doors, fewer fences, fewer gates, fewer locks. I mean, I don't even know if that's a reasonable question, but like, if we were outside more, wouldn't we just naturally make decisions that were better because we could see the effects of the decisions that we're making? We're just so divorced from it now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a rich literature on this question that I haven't honestly explored as much as I'd like, but I think we're like 10,000 years divorced from it. Like, wow. We're living an agricultural way of life. I mean, you know, indigenous people around the world, like the word, I mean, indigenous suggests it's like a way of living permanently and like flexibly in a space, and like it's a multi-generational, you know, not only the accumulated knowledge of generations, but also like a lifelong apprenticeship of like learning your place and all the species within it. Like, I always think about like all the time that, you know, I spend like clicking on, well, this year it was 538, but, yeah. You know, and just like reading, and just like doing anything. Like, people in the past would have just spent that time, like, or a lot of that time, just like engaging directly with other species in a specific place. And so, you know, I think it's like hard to overstate how different that is from our existence. We're just, you know, I know basically one other species really well, and that's dogs. Like, I sort of get the things that all dogs do. It's like, all, you know, you see that species and you're like, oh, dogs have this characteristic as a rule. Mm-hmm. But like, every species has those quirks, you know, like every single species has their own rich set of characteristics. And people in the past would have known those much better and probably known how to interact with them and cared about them in a more direct way than what we experience. So I don't know if that's an answer, but it just is like, I think we're just, I don't know if it's simply a problem of like too many fences or just like our entire way of life for a long time.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like, I think those are sort of the symbols for something that's so much deeper and so much, I mean, I've mentioned this example on the show before, but I remember when I did spend some time in the in Tambopata, which is a river on the Peruvian Amazon. And, you know, I was there for like a week and I went upriver two separate times. So I was at three different locations along the river. And they're pretty remote, like, you know, hours and hours on the boat to get there. And I remember when I first, and granted, I was there during a friaje, which is like this storm that brings in cold winds. And so it actually does affect the wildlife a little bit. But beyond that, I think I had a similar experience to what a lot of people have, where when I first got there, I was like, people talk about this, like it's the most biodiverse, but it was like, where is everything? Like the forest felt quiet, and it took literally days for me to start hearing things and seeing things because I just was not in any way attuned to them. And now we're talking thousands of years of that distance, tens of thousands of years of that distance. Like even just in 3 days, there was this dramatic shift. So I can only imagine, you know, like little kids out playing in the dirt and their moms and dads are like, oh, you're going to get dirty. Like, don't do that. Don't play with the worm. You know, it's like so sad. Like from the time we're tiny, we're just taught like, ugh, dirt, yuck, negative valence. Come back in where it's clean and acidic and not, you know, outside. Like, have you had that experience? Because you did a lot of reporting for this book, not just visiting a lot of people, but like going and visiting these organisms as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just like realized in the process of reporting this book, hanging out with a lot of naturalists, a lot of people who have sort of made themselves students of nature, basically just like how boundless my ignorance is, and just like still I'm still not very good at identifying trees. Like, you know, we've been talking a lot about people, and which I think is great because really the book is about people interacting with trees. But, you know, so like, even after all this, I'm still not great at identifying species, even species of trees. And I just was kind of reminded of that every time I'd go out in the field with someone who like really was keenly aware of every other species in the places that we were, and also how those species were interacting. You know, I think our general divorce from that kind of even casual naturalism isn't something that happened in the last 50 years. I think it's something that has been underway for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm wondering about your personal experience with, I don't know, I'm kind of reminded of like, I want to say it's Alexandra Horowitz wrote this beautiful book called On Walking, where she like lives in a New York neighborhood, and she, each chapter is a different person she went walking with. So it's like in one chapter, she's walking with her dog and she's really reporting and trying hard to understand and see things through her dog's eyes. Like, why does he do this? Why does he do that? What is he noticing? And then she walks with her toddler, and then she walks with a botanist, and then she walks with some like a geologist who knows all about the different types of stone that are in all the buildings. It's sort of like you've been now walking for what I would assume would be years, because the book is out in final form. And I know I've still not written a book by myself. I've co-authored a book, but I've talked to many authors on Talk Nerdy, and this is a labor of love and it takes a lot of time. So like, are you changed from walking with naturalists?
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, I was like writing about, I was like, oh, I went out in the woods, you know, and some draft was like starting to type out that I was like out in the woods with somebody. Who's like, shit, this is like a lot of walking in the woods with people, and it might be quite repetitive. I mostly avoided that in the end, but you're right. I went on tons of walks in the woods with all sorts of different people, and I guess I wish I could say that I had like. Was a much better naturalist than I was. And I probably am in some ways. But as for like directly learning the species and things, I don't think I picked up as much as I would have liked to. I think the thing again that I did, I think the thing that I learned is to like think more deeply kind of about the arrangement around me rather than just like the individuals and like, mm-hmm. how things, I guess, just the ecology and particularly how that might change over time and where it came from. I think a lot about particularly trees in weird places. There is one fun example. You probably go to Joshua Tree if you're in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. I love it. My best friend has a house there. So I love to kind of get away for the weekend and spend time there.
Yeah. So I can't remember which campground it is, but it's like one of the main campgrounds in Joshua Tree. Like a mile out of this campground, just on a main trail, there is kind of this little desert spring, and there is a eucalyptus tree growing by this spring, which is just so crazy. Like it's a tree from Australia growing in the middle of this desert in California, like miles away from any other eucalyptus tree, and like so things like that I really like to look at and ponder, and I think I've probably gotten better at noticing those sorts of things.
That's like interesting. Strange. Yeah. I sometimes, it's funny because even the way that we conceptualize the question and answer, like I think it's so societally induced that like when I ask, are you changed through this? The answer is kind of like, let me take stock in my skill acquisition or like my knowledge, shift in my knowledge. But like, even beyond what you've learned, like, are you a different person? Like, do you think differently? Do you feel differently when you're outside? I know it's kind of hard because it's like, how do you even verbalize this? But I don't know, has this actually shifted you at all? Do you want to be outside more?
I think
it's pretty horrible. Like I need to work on that. You know, I know it's outside. Like, I know I should, but ugh.
Yeah. I mean, I would say I know one thing I know about myself is that, and I've particularly learned over like the last few years of just, political turmoil and whatnot, is like when I'm stressed out, like really the best cure is to like turn off my phone and go out in the woods and like not listen to music, not do anything, just look at the different things that are out there and like just like focus on, I suppose, other life than like, you know, what's happening on 538. So and I mean, not to just like hobble back to skills and acquisitions, but you know, I think I learned a lot in this process about how the world has changed in the past, and kind of assuming a sort of uniformitarianism that, you know, things will as they have been in the past, so they'll be in the future. I think it's hard not to sort of look around me and like try to look for signs of change, even though and just imagine how things will change, even though it's as I said at the beginning, you know, if you're not paying really close attention in one place for a long time, it's hard to tell how things are changing. But I think it's hard not to look for that in any case.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I don't know, like just very human. It's hard that we're like so sort of hemmed in by our own evolutionary pressures. So our brains developed in a certain way to deal with certain acute problems. And because of that, we navigate the world in a very restricted way. We think of it as the everything because it's us, right? So everything is open to us. But really, there's a prescribed way that people think.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We have to work really hard to sort of like break some of these cognitive biases and break through some of these really restrictive patterns. And I think that, yeah, like going outside and being around trees, it's so stupid how simple it is, but like it's profound for a lot of people. Like it actually changes you. And we're not just talking like, you know, psychologically, but like physiologically. Like there are measurable changes that exist when you're just outside for a while.
Trees are great, you know. People love trees. People should spend more time loving trees. and you know, to your point about the way that we're wired and not wired, I mean, I wish I had like the citations for this, but I think there are good examples of, and I'm thinking of like some of the native cultures in the Southwest and their relation to time. Like, I think there are cultural examples of, I think there are examples of cultures kind of serving as an antidote to the very short-term thinking of like what we experience in kind of modern capitalist society. I think
absolutely.
You know, there's a psychological aspect of like, yeah, I want candy right now. And I don't give a shit if like it means I get less candy later or my ancestors get less candy. But I think there is, you know, there's like cultural antidotes to that we could probably develop or work on anyway.
I completely agree. Yeah. This idea that just because something like it's easy to fall into a certain pattern doesn't mean that we have to foster that pattern. Like, you know, it just happens to be the case that in sort of modern Western, like you mentioned even before, colonial and definitely capitalist society, the patterns are so ingrained that we think of them as the way it has to be or the only way it ever could be. But you're right. Like, all you have to do is kind of go to other places in the world and visit other people and observe to see that like my way is not the only way and it's not even necessarily by any stretch the best way. So, okay. Do you have a favorite tree?
I do have a favorite tree and I wrote about it a little bit in the book and not as much as I would have liked. But it's black spruce, which okay. Picea mariana. It's one of the most common trees in North America. It's got a range that goes all the way from Newfoundland to Alaska and dips down into Minnesota and even as far south as New Jersey. And it's kind of like a lot of people who know it would maybe think it's a funny choice because it's kind of like what's the character in Peanuts, where he always has flies around him.
Was that Linus?
Pigpen, I think.
Pigpen, you're right. Linus has the blanket. Yeah, it's Pigpen. Yeah.
It's really dirty. Oh, you know. It's kind of that tree. Like, it's just sort of shabby and like, you know, the picture, when you see pictures of like the drunken forest where the permafrost is melted and it looks all just scraggly and tipped over, those are often black spruce. And I'm from Alaska and they, you know, kind of they signify like wet ground and often lots of mosquitoes, and so they're just kind of this ridiculous tree, but they're sort of so shabby that I there's something charismatic about them.
I love that. It's like when people get like ugly dogs from the shelter and then they become Instagram famous. Like, it's like he's so ugly, he's adorable.
I'm going to start a black spruce Instagram.
Yes, please. Well, gosh, Zach, obviously there's always more to get into than you can on a podcast. I tend to talk around people's books a little bit instead of like sharing everything in the book, obviously, because I want people to read it. The book is The Journeys of Trees, a story about forest people and the future. Before I let you go, though, I was hoping that you would be willing to answer my closing two questions that I ask everybody who comes on the show, like these kind of big picture questions.
Okay.
This is a weird time. So for people who are listening, and I don't know if I'm going to mention this at the beginning or not, because I don't know if I'm going to remember to. This comes out on Monday. So that is November 9th, but we're recording it on Wednesday, November 4th, which is the day after Election Day, which is like, we don't even know what's going on yet. We might by the time this airs, but right now we don't. It's like pins and needles land. And I only preface that just for context. But of course, if you don't, I want you to answer this question however it's like relevant and kind of salient to you. So the first thing is, you know, when you look to the future, and it could be in whatever context it makes sense. So whether we're talking about trees or whether we're talking about capitalism or populism or, you know, anything that's sort of on your mind lately. Number one, what is the thing that really is keeping you up at night? Like when you're feeling like this is not good, what is that most salient thing to you? But then on the flip side, where are you finding hope? Like, where do you have sort of a genuine and not a lip service, but like an authentic optimism living in you?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's maybe two facets of the same thing. I mean, I think, you know, I do worry deeply, of course, about the political situation, the day-to-day situation, the societal situation, the injustices that happen day by day. And part of what I worry about is that, you know, I think climate change is going to be more visible and more immediate than we often think about. And I think to do that in such a fractured, to deal with that in such a fractured society is a little frightening. And I think it would be better to, I think we would be better equipped to deal with the problems that's going to cause for people if we were able to get along a little bit better. And respect each other a little bit more. I don't know. I guess what gives me hope. I don't know. I think it's always a little more. I think people like apocalypses, apocalypsi. I don't know what that is, because I think it's really easy always to imagine an end to things. And I think it's just sort of easier to imagine things blowing up than continuing on. But, you know, I think species and life and everything else has adapted and will continue. And, you know, whatever response we have to climate change in this generation or future generations, you know, life will continue on. This is not the end of it. I don't think we're creating an apocalypse in the sense of there will be no more life on Earth. So that's like,
it just might not be conducive to our life.
Yeah, which, you know, I guess I'm kind of like, I was about to say this is, I realize this is like not the most hopeful version for most people, probably, because I'm like a little bit relativist about like human existence, like super long term at this point. But I don't know. Like I say, it's easy to imagine things ending. It's harder to imagine them continuing. So, you know, maybe we'll be like some awesome society in, you know, maybe just a few years. That would be great. So.
Yeah, but if not, I mean, I get it. Like, it's, I think it's eschatologically sort of like, you know, apocalyptically hard for people to fathom the idea that like we could kill ourselves off. Like, that's like the worst thing they can imagine. But, and I'm not saying I want that to happen because I don't, but I think you're right. Like, you've become very practiced in your reporting in taking a global perspective, right? In zooming out and looking at the forest for the tree, like literally seeing the forest for the trees. And so when you do that and you start to think about humanity at that scale and that level, I mean, there's so much depth and richness, and it would be an atrocity to lose that depth and richness. But if that's the decision that we're choosing to make for ourselves, at least, you're right, these fundamental macromolecules that are required for life and these, you know, really sort of these species that are able to overcome insurmountable odds, like they kind of give me hope, because it's like, yeah, we as much damage as we are obviously hellbent on causing to our planet, the planet itself is like, F you, I am amazing at figuring out a workaround for this. And yeah. It's weird, like thinking about the fact that we might kill ourselves off, but we will never, ever, we might be able to really harm the planet and scar her in a way that it takes a long time for her to recover. I mean, we're clearly doing that now, but I do think she will recover. And there's kind of like a peace or like a beauty in that.
Yeah. I think there is. I think it's almost like a kind of faith. I think on the other hand, you know, I do think we need to do everything we can to minimize the damage we're doing. And you know, for, you know, as with a lot of the people I talk about in the book, I think, you know, that means individual people doing what they can, you know, doing little tree projects. I think those are good.
Yeah. Agree. Yeah. Do your tree projects, people. I think that's the take.
Get out there.
Get outside. Well, Zach, this has been an illuminating conversation, to say the least. I know it's a very strange time to be getting together to talk about trees, but I also think that it's great, because these kinds of conversations, this is why I love science so much, right? Because at the same time, we can be like distracted from what's going on in the world by this beautiful topic that feels like it in no way relates, but also realize that it's all intimately related, and that, you know, it doesn't require any mental gymnastics to see that what's happening politically and what's happening ecologically are inextricably linked. And so I think that, you know, this was an important conversation, especially today, for perspective. And I thank you for allowing me to interview you and to to join up in that goal. So,
well, thank you for having me.
Of course. Yeah, it was a ton of fun. And again, guys, the book is The Journeys of Trees, A Story About Forests, People, and the Future by Zach St. George. And hey, everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.